Okay, so good afternoon. On Thursday this week, I'll be giving a speech setting out some of the next steps in the government's public sector program. Delivering better public services within tight financial constraints is one of our four priorities for this term. The other priorities are responsibly managing the government's finances, building a more competitive and productive economy, and of course rebuilding Christchurch. Personally, I want a results-focused public service that embraces innovation and flexibility, and is accountable for delivering the results New Zealanders want and, of course, deserve. My speech this week will cover some of the next steps to achieve this and clearly set out the government's expectations. I don't want to go into details today, but I can make a few general points. Firstly, improving the public service is important because the public service makes up about a quarter of New Zealand's economy, so it plays a big part in our overall economic performance. New Zealanders care about the quality of public services they receive. Hospitals for their families, education for their children, and social services, justice for the most vulnerable. And taxpayers who pay the bills quite rightly expect their money to be spent carefully. With those things in mind, over the past 3 years we have focused on two things: reducing costs and increasing efficiency in the public service, and getting better results and improved levels of service. Instead of rushing in and making savage cuts, we've given public service chief executives time to prepare and plan for the new reality of delivering better public services with little or no new money, for example, through the four-year budget planning process. We're making good progress in reducing costs and increasing efficiency as we focus on getting back to surplus in 2014-15. Now we want to focus hard on delivering better results, improving public services for New Zealanders, and being more flexible and innovative in how we do that. We've always said that there'll be a high hurdle for structural change in the public sector. My speech is not going to be about mergers for mergers' sake. So we're not looking at wholesale restructuring, but there is one area of the public sector's operations where we think that structural change is needed. But I'll talk more about that and how we'll get better results in my speech on Thursday. Just in terms of ministerial activity, obviously it's recess week. I'm in Auckland tomorrow, Wednesday I'm in Taupo, Thursday I'm in Auckland, and Friday I'm in the Coromandel electorate. On Sunday I'll be at the start of Round the Bays race in Auckland. I'll be going to the Warriors match, and there's other things on Sunday.
What's that area?
Have to wait till Thursday.
Is that the super ministry around economic development, science, innovation, labour, and immigration?
Well, I'm not going to rule that out, but I'm also not going to rule it in.
Why would that be a better way of approaching that area?
Well, I'm not going to go into the particular areas that we're looking at. What I'm saying in the speech on Thursday quite clearly is that the public have high expectations of the public service, that I don't think we should just have mergers for the sake of them. Where we've had mergers so far in areas like the Ministry for Primary Industries, it's been very logical what we've done. There's one other particular area we want to focus on in terms of where we think gains can be made and synergies can be found, and I'll be in a position to talk more about that on Thursday.
Do you think less money and fewer people means a better public service and better services?
Well, I think we need to modernise the state service, and it's really important that we deliver on a number of things. Firstly, New Zealanders have high expectations of the results they get. So when we think of public services, some people think about how you apply for your passport. Actually, I think about whether kids get a decent education, whether the justice system works for them. Secondly, a big driver of cost is headcount. And of course, we're giving a lot of government departments no extra money. So where they're having to pay for wage rounds, that's leaving them effectively out of pocket and having to make savings in other areas. Thirdly, there are synergies to be gained when you share back offices, when you share support services. We've also been wanting to move resources from the back office to the front office, and I think we've been quite successful about that. So, yes, the headcount has been falling in the state sector, I don't think dramatically, but it has been coming down. It's my expectation will probably go a bit lower, but I'm not foreshadowing absolutely dramatic change, but I am foreshadowing sensible change.
Well, I mean, I think there's been 2,400 jobs lost since you guys took office. Do you expect a similar level of job losses over the next 3 years to reach your $1 billion target that was about last year?
Well, the savings for the $1 billion will come not solely through a reduction in headcount, although that is a part of the cost savings that we will receive. There are other areas like procurement where we can save money, other things that we're doing. So you'll spell that out a bit more holistically.
So how many jobs do you think will go across the sector?
I don't know precisely. I can see some areas where there's going to be structural change, and I can see some areas where there's some savings going on. But really, every government department is looking at it.
Is it hundreds or is it thousands? I mean, how the public going to get a handle on how big this is going to be?
Well, as I said, it's not change for the sake of change, and it's not driven by a magic number. It's driven by a better result in a more affordable environment.
You've already had pushback from NFAT, Ministry of Defence. Have you gone too hard and fast and maybe overreached in some of these changes?
I don't think you'd actually say we've had tremendous pushback in defence. Yes, morale is arguably a slightly lower level, but it's still from quite a high base. And actually, if you look at defence, one of the strong things that came through when we did the defence white paper was they want more money to spend on different assets and in different areas. And so in case of defence, yes, they're making savings, but they get to use all of those savings in other initiatives that they want to fund. So there may be some people that are unhappy, but I wouldn't necessarily describe the whole Defence Force as unhappy. In the case of NFAT, yes, it's slightly different. Obviously, there's been some pushback, but an important point to note with NFAT is we are going through a consultation process. The Chief Executive is legally required to do that, and is legally required to take on board that feedback. And I imagine he will.
Are you going to back away from some of your proposals around NFAT?
Well, I think it's really important to understand that the Chief Executive's, that is the responsibility of the neutral state sector. But I think he'll take on board the feedback, and I'd be amazed if he ends up delivering on all the things he's consulting on. I think there will be some change, but that's a matter for him.
Where do you think that change might occur?
I don't want to foreshadow that today. I mean, he hasn't even finished the consultation process, but we value the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but we are trying to modernise it.
Are you concerned it was too aggressive by Chief Executive by the Minister, 305 on jobs? Do you think it was too big, too soon?
Well, firstly, it's clearly run by the Chief Executive. I mean, the State Sector Act is absolutely crystal clear in terms of whose obligations and responsibilities they are to reform the state sector. Too aggressive. Look, in some areas they might be a little bit aggressive, and you might have to step back.
So there was no government direction to NFAT to find cost savings? This was completely off their own initiative?
No, they need to find cost savings. That's not the directive. The directive is how you find those cost savings. We are a purchasing agent, so it's quite within the State Sector Act for a minister to give an indication of where the government's going. We've been doing that for quite some time, telling chief executives they need to live within their baseline. It's no different from us going to police and saying to the police commissioner, there'll be no extra money for this budget cycle, as we have said to the police commissioner. But it's for the police commissioner rightfully to identify where those savings might be found to fund the other cost increases that he faces within both police.
You've just said that you didn't want to foreshadow areas where NFAT might draw back, but then saying it's totally up to them as a neutral chief executive. So are you aware of...
Well, I'm well and truly aware of the feedback. I mean, anyone can see that. And there's an intranet site where NFAT employees are being encouraged to go out and give their feedback. I think the spouses of NFAT staff have released a letter today, an open letter today, as I understand it. I mean, I'd be absolutely amazed if the Chief Executive doesn't take that on board, because there's a legal obligation to do that.
But there'll be no direction from the government?
The government's the purchaser, and we want to see an efficient state Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade that works well. We want to see one that achieves the objective we've got, which is to reduce their costs and be modernised. How that's carried out is a matter for the Chief Executive.
You said that some of the proposals might be too aggressive, in fact. What areas are you talking about there?
I think some around compensation are likely to be a bit aggressive. I mean, at the end of the day, there are genuine issues there. Spouses do accompany their partner more often than not on a foreign posting, and they don't always get the opportunity to take up employment in the locations they go to. So I think that's one area where he'll have a look. But as I say, I've had lots of anecdotal feedback to me as well. I'm sure that same feedback has been fed into the system. In the end, I'm sure John and I will go and work his way through all that and eventually come up with a set of proposals that he thinks fits what's required.
There's a sense of the process to appoint a new Chief Executive of the Department of Labour has been suspended. Is that due to the proposed changes in terms of likely moves?
No, I don't think so. I certainly haven't seen a new recommendation, but they worked their way through that. It's been one or two other recommendations, but they haven't got to that yet.
There's been quite a lot of speculation around the super ministry, around the economic development, immigration, labour. You said you didn't want to talk about that because it's not happening, but because you want to announce no wins now.
No, I'll just repeat what I said earlier, which is I'm not ruling anything in and I'm not ruling it out. I'm happy to talk about it on Thursday. If you want to speculate before then, I can't stop telling you through doing that.
Isn't it a bit of a cop out to say the responsibility lies on the how, relies on the chief executives, because they can only play the cards that you deal them, and you're not giving them any more money. In fact, you're giving them cuts because they're getting no inflation adjusted rises.
No, and I encourage you to go and read the State Sector Act. It lays out quite clearly whose responsibilities they are and who is required to carry out any reforms that take place. I mean, if ministers are going to do that, then they'll very quickly find themselves in breach of the State Sector Act. It's quite clear the government has less money and is either asking some departments to live with less money or the same amount of money. That's absolutely within our prerogative. It's also within our prerogative as the purchaser to make it clear what our objectives are. But it's the responsibility of the chief executive to come up with that plan and to execute that plan.
So when Mr. McCulley says that he didn't want to see any cuts to the UN, for instance, that's part of the government's definition of what its priorities are?
That's his definition of as the purchaser of what he thinks is important. It's the responsibility, I would have thought, of any good chief executive to work with their minister and say, what are you trying to achieve and what are you trying what do you see as a priority? That's why there's a briefing to the incoming minister. That's why ministers meet with chief executives on a weekly basis. But the actual plan and how that plan is executed is the legal responsibility of the chief executive.
Well, it's stretching credulity a bit far to think that a minister, especially one as active, if you like, as Mr. McCulley, would allow a proposal to get as far as this without at least having some input into what it said and the direction it was taking beyond the level that you're talking about.
Well, you need to take that question up directly with the minister, but certainly in terms of discussions I've had with the minister, he has certainly given clear indications of what his purchasing requirements are, but my understanding is the program and plan that's been put together was formed by the chief executive with the change consultants that he employed.
Prime Minister, just changing the subject, just looking at the investor plus category for immigration, with just 10 people, including Pim.com, coming in on that, are you happy that the way that scheme has been working, has that been as effective as you would have liked?
Well, it's more successful than the previous scheme was, and it's seen, for the most part, people coming to New Zealand that are making a real contribution. And, you know, whether ultimately Kim.com has breached international law is not a matter for me to opine on. That's a matter for the US authorities who are taking that case. But in terms of the general category, actually having high net worth individuals coming to New Zealand, in my view, adds value. You've seen that with Julian Robertson, you've seen it, I think you'll see it with James Cameron when he comes. And in fact, the Herald today ran, I thought, quite an interesting piece on the number of high net worth individuals that are coming and what they're doing in New Zealand.
What about the fact that most of them have just invested the $10 million and no more? Effectively, they've just stopped once they've done enough to come in on the category.
Well, I think that's a very narrow definition of what they're actually doing. So they might invest that in their bonds or whatever it might be, but in fact their overall activities are usually significantly greater than that.
So that goes with the fact that lots of them have invested 77% of the monies in bonds, very passive form.
They do, but they more often go off and do a great many other things. I mean, look, it's not for me to go into the individual activities of a person, but you take Peter Field, for instance, from Facebook, who's spent some time in New Zealand. That's very well known. He made a significant donation to Christchurch. He's been undertaking a number of other, so I understand it, private investments in different activities. He's doing quite a lot of things in New Zealand. I mean, he's just one example of many high net worth individuals who, I don't know where he might be investing $10 million in terms of that scheme. Those overall activities in New Zealand are reasonably
significant. So Peter Thiel came in under this category?
Don't know, but he's that type of person.
Yeah. So the gains are beyond what they...
Well, that's my view. I mean, you're never going to have thousands of people in this category, but you are going to have some very important people. And, you know, Julian Robertson's given the single biggest donation of art in Australasian history. We gave him an honorary knighthood for that. New Zealand will be better off to the tune of well over $100 million worth of art because of his affection for New Zealand and the time he spent down here. He's also developed significant properties which are major tourist attractions, which otherwise wouldn't be there if he's not there. So, in my view, if James Cameron comes to New Zealand and ends up making more movies here and various other things, New Zealand will be a strong beneficiary of that. It'll create more jobs. And in James Cameron's case, we're doing it in a very environmentally sensitive way. So, I personally support people coming in that category. And there'll never be, as I say, massive numbers, but there aren't massive numbers of these people around the world.
What about the criticism that just lets the super rich buy New Zealand residency?
Every country has a category of why people are allowed in, but in my view, the category is that they should be able to make a contribution to New Zealand that's positive, bring their skills, bring their capital, hopefully bring their enthusiasm for New Zealand. The vast overwhelming bulk of people that come to New Zealand do not come in the super rich category. They come as students, where they bring, you know, their potential skills to play, or they come in a category where they're not nearly as well off as these people, but they make a significant contribution. So if you're talking about how the majority of people come to earn New Zealand residency and ultimately citizenship, it's not because they're super wealthy. The fact that we let a few super wealthy people in, well, they've got to meet the same criteria as everybody else. They've still got to be good citizens. They've still got to be committed to New Zealand, and they've got to be able to make a contribution.
In terms of the re-evaluation of the Crayfar Farms, but where matter is that?
Mine seems sitting for the Overseas Investment Office.
Because the indication was in the aftermath of that High Court decision that the government hoped to have a re-evaluation done within a matter of a couple of weeks.
I don't think that's right, actually. I think the minister actually said it'd be in a few days, and I said I don't think it'd be anywhere near a few days.
Okay, so has any sort of time frame beyond that been settled as of yet?
No.
Have you decided whether to appeal the judge's ruling on that?
I think we've decided we're not going to.
You're not going to?
No, we've looked closely at it and decided not to.
Does the further appeal by the Faith Consortium complicate matters around re-evaluation?
No, it doesn't.
With regard,
well, following the attack in Afghanistan by the American rogue soldier, have you had any reports about heightened tensions or increased risks for New Zealand troops in Afghanistan?
No. I mean, look, I don't have a great many details about the situation that took place overnight. I mean, obviously, it's an individual who's clearly cracked under the pressure, and it's a tragedy, but probably shows you the level of pressure that some of these soldiers are under.
In terms of the SAS, are they out yet, or are they coming out this month?
No, the funding back at the end of the month is a very small piece that will be left just as the Norwegians taking over from us and just as they transition through, but essentially we're out by the end of March.
Have you had any update from police on the project?
No.
Just on the speech, why did you choose Thursday?
Well, we believe it or not, serendipity, but we booked it on the 13th of February. We didn't know that the insurer was giving a speech that day. It takes us more than a couple of days to put together a location and then to put together the
audience. Where is your speech, sorry?
It's in Auckland Chamber of Commerce.
But you're not unhappy to be delivering a major speech on the same day that the new Labour leader is delivering his first major speech as well?
Well, I'm not bothered by it. Hopefully he'll do a better job than his private members will.
Why is Dr. Wayne...
At least then maybe we'll read the next page and won't figure out important things like our natural flora and fauna.
Why is Dr. Wayne Matt the best qualified person to be appointed to the Law Commission?
Well, he's got a PhD in international law. He's worked in the creation of the law as a Budget Minister of the Crown and as a Member of Parliament. He's had a distinguished career as a lawyer. And, you know, I think he fits all of the criteria. The recommendation came from the Minister, but I was more than happy to support it.
Why wasn't he measured against other candidates, given that six names were mentioned in September of last year, but not reconsidered in January of this year?
Well, I think he was considered. I mean, at the end of the day, the government always considers all of the potential nominations that it has. It doesn't mean it needs to do further investigation if it thinks there's one standout.
Well, those other names, according to the papers released by Judge Collins, they weren't rechecked for availability. It was just Dr. Mapp's name that was put forward, which has led to your political opponents leveling the accusation of a cronyism appointment.
Well, I assume they didn't make the same criticisms when Geoffrey Palmer was appointed.
Just because it wasn't right then, does that make it right now?
Well, I didn't say Geoffrey Palmer wasn't right, actually.
So you're satisfied that proper process has been followed in Dr. Mapp's appointment?
Absolutely. Okay, see you next time.